Retreat centers are known for their flora and fauna. This retreat center is known for its flora and sauna. I'm Bruce Wallenberg, and I teach religious studies at the University of Idaho in Moscow, and also direct the Campus Christian Center in that place. However, I'm a resident of Pullman, Washington, which is 8 miles away. So some people have bi-coastal marriages. I have a bi-state job, as does my spouse who works in Lewiston, Idaho. And on our little street, Green Hill Road, just about every other house is inhabited by a couple, both of whom have PhDs. You could wipe out a lot of doctors just by, you know, a cluster bomb on Green Hill Road. So my pastor said that Pullman, for its size and statistically, is the most educated place in the country. Has the most, you know, highly educated people in the country. Be that as it may, across the street we have a paradox. both of whom are pharmacologists, therefore both of whom are scientists, one of whom goes periodically to Washington, D.C. to sit on a jury for grants, National Science Foundation grants. And this is a lead-in to, or it's my way of identifying a little bit personally with the topic for tonight, which is ethics, science, and public policy. This scientist, Dick Okeda, is very much a part of the governmental mechanism, in other words, the public policy mechanism, that dictates to a great extent what kind of science gets done in this country. Now, that being said, we've got two pieces of that. We've got public policy and we've got science. How do we fit ethics in there? Science and technology tends to say what can be done should be done, right? Well, what can be done is science. But public policy says what should be done. What is the relationship between that should, you should do, we will give you this grant and you should do the following things with it for us in terms of defense or whatever. Where does ethics fit in? Now, that's a very general topic, and the committee was wrestling with that, and we felt that rather than narrow it down to one particular aspect of science or and public policy, for example, global warming, which is on a lot of people's minds, we would rather leave it general and have our panel of resident experts here, each member of which give a 5-minute personal response to this topic, ex corde, from the heart, cor ad cor loquitur. Who said that?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Are any of them registered lobbyists? You're talking about going to Washington. Immediately, I pay their salary if that's the case.
Yeah.
I'd like to know if any of them are registered lobbyists.
Are you a registered lobbyist? No? Are your guns registered? And is your cat neutered? That's the important thing. You know, all those cats running around. Who cares if they have guns? You can't shoot them all. So, our first, the format, or in Detroit's a format, is as follows. We need that. Yeah. All musically talented people except for Al.
Absolutely right.
Absolutely. Our format is as follows. After I mercifully shut up, I will introduce the Reverend Dr. Al Pitcher, who will give his cor ad cor loquitur for 5 minutes. And I will be the timer, and I'll give you a 1-minute warning signal, which I haven't thought of yet what it will be, but I will give you 1 minute. And that will give you 1 minute to wrap up. Yes,
hold
sir.
Hold up your popcorn.
Yeah. All right, and this is called the elevation of the popcorn in liturgical language. And when you see that, know that the end is nigh.
horrible porn on it.
Yeah.
I'll treat it as I would the bishop.
From a Baptist, that's ominous.
Is mic connected to anything? Some of us don't hear too well. I haven't been able to hear.
No, I don't think the mic is on. Can you hear me?
I'm fine.
Okay, well, that's all that's important. Well, Al will talk loud. He's good. And then Dale will hold forth for another 5 minutes. And then the Reverend Dr. Professor Herr Professor tenure track and vibes man Mark Johnson will also do the same. And then we'll open the floor for questions. And we'll quit when the hour is up. So without further ado, Al, please.
I got involved in social science in trying to think through what Christians should be about and what the church should be about. And I found that most churches and most Christians didn't have the foggiest notion about what the implications were, that is, on the whole, of what they were doing. So they would make all these pronouncements. So I decided to study social science systematically. I don't believe that you can get out of the Bible or from any kind of hocus-pocus public policy that's intelligent and responsible without some social science. Well, as soon as I began to study the social scientists, I discovered that the social scientists also were persons with considerable interests in life, some of them very monetarily involved. They also were persons with worldviews, with what I would call a way of looking at being, which influenced what they saw. So I would read the social scientists and found that they disagreed. And then I was looking for why they disagreed, and I taught many courses in which I'd take a couple of economists and just analyze their presuppositions. What are their presuppositions about being? I found the scientists had quite different presuppositions about being, and their science was affected by their presuppositions about being. I don't know anything about physical science or all the stuff that these guys do, because I haven't studied it in detail. But in principle, I would say the same thing applies. And the mentor under whom I worked took the physical sciences and showed how they also had presuppositions about the nature of the world and being that influenced what they thought. So I there's no way to take anything that anybody says simply without understanding the context in which they see. There aren't any facts, according to me, that just kind of are there. They're always interpreted facts. So when you look at global warming or any other issue, the interpretations you get and the appropriations of whatever data is out there are all influenced by one's worldview. And modern science, economic science, is so biased and so inadequate from my point of view in its worldview that I don't think there's any possibility of getting out our present colleges with their economic theorists having the worldviews they do, for the most part, any adequate advice. Now, accidentally, the advice might be good. But in principle, they look at the world in a way which is quite different from the way I do. And therefore, they are, for the most part, going to advocate different things from what I would advocate. So when we look at global warming, we have three or four different perspectives. Some people say, well, there's nothing you can do about it anyway, because in this way of being that we have in this country and the science and the institutions, you've got to wait for the people to come along, and you've got to wait for the initiations to come, which will change things. And since we don't have very long-term perspectives on the whole, they say people aren't going to do anything about these issues that have long-term perspectives anyway, so you might just as well wait until things work out, till they and then we'll accommodate, we'll take care of things after we see what happens. Anyway, perhaps that's enough for me to say.
Exemplary. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dale.
As an educator in science, and I've, and as somebody who has been seeing events unfolding, I guess, and people's backgrounds in those events, I've become very concerned over the last few years as to the decision-making process that tries to combine, as we're talking about here, public policy, science, technology, and so on, sort of an educated view of the world around us as to how these things couple together. I see in my students when I'm teaching a large gap in their understanding of how science and technology works, let alone being able to incorporate that back into a decision-making process that affects all of us. The course of science technology these days, in my view, is accelerating enormously rapidly, so fast that even people in the fields have a hard time keeping up sometimes, let alone those who do not operate closely in the areas of science and technology. As a result of that, we are continually throwing out new problems to be considered, new questions that need to be answered. They are in areas such as weapons research, or, for instance, global warming, medical research, areas in which problems are being posed, ethical questions that we've never encountered before. Sustaining life, decision making on types of life that we think are appropriate, perhaps. I mean, those options are now becoming available in a medical world. But in order to start making decisions as they apply to those, we need to have an education that allows us to communicate in an intellectual way, in an intelligent way, in terms of trying to understand the issues at hand. There are a lot of issues that are being driven by, in my view, a lack of understanding of the problem. In other words, things become reactionary rather than an understanding of what occurs. And I guess it's my concern that there be a way of bridging gaps, developing ways of getting various groups, ethicists, theologians, scientists, to begin a communication that will close that gap. A friend of mine is fond of saying that there seems to be a developing scientific priesthood, if you will, a group of people who seem to hold all the secrets. And that's not the way, in my view, that things should be working. But rather, it needs to be a world view and a world understanding of what's going on.
Thanks. Mark, you want to take over?
Okay. To echo a little bit of what Dale said about education, I think science often gets a lot of the blame for problems that we have, particularly environmental problems that we have in the world today. I want to underscore that I think proper education is essential for the whole public to make decisions regarding some of the problems that come up that Dale referred to that involve advances in science and technology. It is, I think, the responsibility of the citizenry and thus the government to strongly support educational systems such that everybody understands what science is and what science is not, so that everybody can participate in the value aspects of the questions. I'm not saying that everybody has to become scientists. That's impossible because science is very complicated. But everybody has to understand the process of science so that they can take part in the value questions. Let me give you an example. I heard a man speak several weeks ago about global warming. Again, this tonight isn't necessarily about global warming, but it's a convenient example. As Dale mentioned this week in some of the Elder Hostel sessions, trying to predict what global warming will do is nearly impossible. There are some facts. The amount of CO2 which causes the greenhouse effect is increasing in the atmosphere. Almost certainly a fact is that increase is due to us driving our cars to work,
burning coal, all that kind of stuff. Another fact is that CO2 in the atmosphere heats up the planet. Those are all facts, indisputable. The question then is, how much will it heat up? The models that scientists use are very complicated. They use computers. And understandably, in a very complicated system, there's a lot of variables. What are the ocean currents doing? How high are the continents? Are there glaciers on the poles, et cetera, et cetera? All kinds of different variables that are going to change the weather system on the planet. How can we can't predict weather 3 days from now. How can we predict what increased CO2 is going to do? So the nature of the system is such that you can't know for sure what's going to happen. All right, this is the point I want to make. There are some scientists, based on certain assumptions, letting those variables flop this way, that say, my gosh, in 100 years, the average global temperature is going to be 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer. All the polar ice caps are going to melt. All the corn belt is going to dry up. All these kind of, oh no, my gosh, everything's going to hell in a handbasket scenario. There are also scientists that have a different set of variables. And they project somewhat lower, saying, well, in 100 years, the temperature might rise a little bit, but it's not going to be a very serious kind of thing. This is what scientists have come up with. They end up coming up with a range of scenarios. Unfortunately, what happens in the media is that people that have some interest to play, let's say people that make their living having people burn their coal or their gasoline, or people that are rabid environmentalists, I mean, they have an interest, a political interest, in trumpeting one of these scenarios. So we have the Sierra Club and we have the Earth Firsters saying, oh, the world's going to end in 100 years because it's getting so warm and everything like that. And somebody else coming out and saying, well, look, if these scientists say that it's only going to rise a degree or two. We have these political concerns, people bickering back and forth, and the general lay people say, well, what good is science? Science doesn't have any ability to know what's going to happen. So people end up throwing up their hands and not trusting science because they don't understand that this range of options is something that science comes up with. It's the nature of the game. Okay. But at that point, that's where the scientists don't leave it behind. The scientists produce their scenarios, produce their data. That's where the scientist's job ends. After that, it is everybody's job, including the scientists, everybody's job to make a value decision. If these are the two scenarios, a worst case and a best case, chances are that reality is going to be somewhere in between. Who knows about that? The point is, at that point, everybody needs to understand is that we're throwing dice, we're taking chances. It's a value decision that everybody can understand. Are we going to continue to live in the way we do and risk having a future that any of these scenarios describe? Are we going to say, well, it's probably nothing's going to happen, so I'm just going to continue to live the way that I want to live? That's a value decision. It's one that everybody makes. So what's essential, I think, is for educational system supported by government, if it has to make sure that people, the general populace, know what science is and what science is not, so that they can help in making informed value decisions. They can't leave the value decisions up to the scientists. Scientists have an obligation to make it as clear as possible to the public. That's part of their responsibility. But it's the responsibility of the public to do their best in understanding. And the real bad guys in this situation are, I think, the people that take advantage of this mushiness of science and use it to their own political advantage. That's really bad.
As you're talking, I think of Neil Postman's book about television and how we're entertaining ourselves to death, that the very medium that is thrown up by science and technology that could be an educational tool of tremendous magnitude is anesthetizing people. So they watch, you know, candy news and sports, which I particularly don't like, and other things, whereas the National Geographic specials and all the, those kinds of things that could introduce people to science are not being watched. So there's a paradox right there in the box. Well, thank you, and we'll entertain questions. You can address them to a particular panelist or throw it open to the whole panel. Yeah?
I have a question for Al. About 45 years ago, I was told that soap was invented 2 years after dirt was discovered. What is a social scientist? The statement seems disconnected, but what in the world is his job? To go around inventing? Discovering? What is a social scientist?
To explain how things work.
That's what they're doing.
Or human systems. Why societies develop the way they do, why populations
they explain the natural world, we explain the social world.
With all of the unemployment and the people sleeping in the streets, and what do they say, one out of five children at risk, that these people are still operating? You know, I'm not putting them down. I don't understand their role.
Yeah, we can jump in, but let's raise our hands so that we have a flow of conversation. Everybody gets a chance to speak. Yeah.
I think she said the same thing I did. The social scientists are the people that come up with this, some of the statistics that you just quoted. They provide some of that information that can help lead to some awareness. And I think it's pretty important,
though. But it does make a great deal of difference which social scientist interprets what's the meaning of that data. And let me ride my horse that most of our economic social scientists have a theory of social science with which I do not agree, and that's what's taught, and so your education isn't necessarily the answer. I mean, if you read For the Common Good, which is a book by a theologian and an erstwhile social scientist, Herman Daly. Some people question whether he's an economist because he's a steady-state economist. They don't agree with the steady-state theory, so they don't say he's an economist. But their theory is that our universities are so diversified and so fragmented, and that people don't talk to each other from one department to another, and they don't have to deal with the whole. That's their theory. And therefore you get an economic science, which is an abstraction from reality, which doesn't deal with the kinds of questions that you're asking about.
Are they too intellectual?
Well, no, except tangentially. They say if the system produces enough, it will take care of everybody, if it produces enough.
Yes, sir.
I've got a question related to ethics and science and education. I'm not sure the numbers, but a huge proportion of the federal grants to colleges and universities for research goes into military weaponry and military sources and military applications. And I'm wondering how the universities can maintain an ethical stance when we know the political ideology behind that kind of thing and what they're asked to produce. I'm not saying that your universities and colleges aren't, but you must be familiar with that process.
Who wants to respond? Dale, you want to respond?
Yeah, actually, that's a real problem. However, most of the monies, at least that I'm aware, end up going to the national laboratories rather than the colleges and universities. That just shifts the picture over a little bit. That doesn't necessarily change the question much. There is some that comes to the colleges and universities too, and there are those who have made conscious decisions not to be involved in that, for instance, and there are those who do. But the funding that comes in is often quite focused. There are a series of national laboratories around the country. Probably the most well-known of those is Los Alamos, because it was one of the first, which is where the Manhattan Project, the atom bomb, was developed. And I happen to spend a lot of time down there because they have big, fast computers for modeling the insides of stars as well. But that's also a place where they spend a lot of time doing weapons research like Star Wars and so on. So it's a lot of your tax dollars that goes that direction. So that's a policy decision being made very high up within government that is focusing those funds in that direction.
You had a question.
Well, it's been partially answered already, but my concern is the economics of the whole picture. I was actually pointing in that direction when I asked if we had registered lobbyists here. We have a bunch of politicians that, in the first place, they don't trust, and the second place, don't feel qualified to make these decisions that they're saying must be made at that level. So if that's the case, the decisions are going to have to be made at an intellectual level that I, for one, at least, would trust, which would be back at the, primarily at the level these people are representing. And no matter how they go about the bureaucratic grab bag, whether they're called registered lobbyists or not, if they are influencing these unqualified people to make these decisions for them, just so they can get their hands on the money, I don't agree with it. Now, any one of them can try to answer this if they want to.
Is there a President's Science Advisory Board? And does that relate at all to what Andy is talking about?
One exists.
Yeah.
Whether it's functional or not. It's another question.
I mean, that would be sort of like what you're talking about, a group
one
of peers, scientists.
I agree with one exists, but from an ethical standpoint, since we're including ethics in this, I don't think there's much ethics involved. It's just who can get their mouth in the public trough.
I don't think.
I mean, that's been my observation.
I don't think it's quite
what
that,
goes on.
Quite that dark.
And I was including the social.
Because I have a couple of friends in Congress, and I have the utmost respect for them in terms of their seriousness about trying to get a hold of facts and trying to get a hold of what's going on, and some concern for the common good. Not just representing people, but for an overall view of how they can serve everybody.
Mark, do you want to jump in?
It's not really connected to what you said, but I was trying to think in my mind of a group of scientists at a high level that might offer comments on public policy. Probably the most prestigious association of scientists is the American Association for the Advancement of Science. They put out a journal called Science, and most scientific disciplines, you publish your papers in journals, and there's reams and reams of astronomy journals and geology journals, but if you get an article published in Science, then you're really kind of hot stuff. And they have a very they see it as part of their responsibility to make comments, editorial comments on public issues that involve science. And I would say most of their stances you would have to categorize as being quite liberal, saying trying to advance education, trying to advance government funding for research, not on weaponry, but on alternative energy sources and this type of thing. This would be one of the most, I think Dale would agree to, one of the most prestigious bodies of scientists in the country. But they're, when I read their editorials, I would say most of them are different from what seems to be the public policy coming out of Washington.
Right. We have a lot of them in the library here.
I agree
with you.
Okay.
And not many of the American public really, unless they happen to come to a place like this or something, have access to them unless they know about it. And,
that's
and
true,
most
that's
of
right.
the general public, in my opinion, in the United States, don't even know that those scientific journals, I call them, mm-hmm. exist. Now, I read them regularly, but maybe I'm the exception because nobody else that I
that's
talk
good.
To seems to know they exist.
That's part of my concern about this big education gap.
Right.
Well, most of our students grow up in elementary schools thinking that science is hard and boring. And, I mean, education has to...
But it's much more than education. I mean,
yeah.
Germany was the most educated, cultured country in the world mm-hmm. when Hitler came to power.
Yeah.
There's something more than simply being a scientist or having certain facts or being exposed to certain reality systematically, which is what science is.
Bill and then Nancy.
A friend of mine told me the other day of a story that, I don't know if it's true or not, but somebody was on an expedition, and it doesn't really matter where, but the porters were native, and they were rushing this expedition along, and the porters stopped at one stage. And in trying to get them to move, they pushed them more, and the porter said, "We can't." And when they asked why, the response eventually came back saying, "We're waiting for our souls to catch up." I think the problem here, as I see it anyway, as I reflect on it, is that I think science and so many things in our world have outstripped ethics. They've moved along too fast. I think the recent war is a good example. Our technology in that war far outstripped our moral responsibilities. Our ability to manipulate communication was also another example of that. And so people fell into a pattern of support for something that is beyond understanding to me anyway. I don't think we're going to be able to slow down science. I don't think we want to. I don't think that's the point. I think we need to figure out how to catch ethics up. We know how to solve the homeless problem. We know how to solve crime. We know how to take care of those issues. We know how to keep people off drugs. The point is we're not committed to it. We don't have the will to do it because it takes long-range planning and it takes some real commitment on our parts on how to deal with that. We've not had that whole element caught up with the speed that our society is moving, with the speed that technology is moving, with the speed that education is moving, or science is moving. I don't know how to move that faster. Our structures that did that aren't doing it now. Family isn't, church isn't, and I don't know what else is responsible for doing that, but it's not moving that.
School.
It's not catching that up. That part of it just isn't
working. I think our schools are much too technical. I think they ought to deal with these issues seriously. We used to deal with them at the University of Chicago, where I was for about 50 years, and the departments got their hands on all the programs for the undergraduates and gradually whittled it away until they got into the science and not into the integration and not into the thinking about the larger issues of value. And so I don't see our schools as much help right now, really, to tell you the truth.
Nancy?
Follow up on some things that Mark had mentioned, which actually are quite closely related to what Al was just talking about. I think it was really interesting when you talked about the fact, the range of possibilities within a scientific understanding of a particular issue, and that most of us commonly don't have a very deep understanding of some basic things about science and scientific understanding, scientific knowledge, mm-hmm. the limits of science, mm-hmm. and all of those kinds of things. And then what was so beautiful was that you talked about the responsibility of all of us, and it really felt like a circle as you mm-hmm. were describing mm-hmm. that idea. The responsibility of all of us to make value judgments and how we need to be better informed about science mm-hmm. in doing that. And you know, really what's missing is not just an inability to understand science mm-hmm. or perceive the limits of science, mm-hmm. but the ability to do that mm-hmm. conversation mm-hmm. around that circle, mm-hmm. the shared language, the shared understandings, the commitments, and ethicists would say an ability to do ethics in any kind of a common realm, that folks don't have experience or knowledge in that field either. And that that it inhibits our ability to do that very important wrestling with values and coming to shared understandings in that circle.
Okay.
I want to wait till we went around.
Raise your hand if you want to speak. And I'll...
The title that was chosen tonight, Ethics and, Ethics, Science, and Public Policy, is there a perceived lack of ethics in science?
Not, I wouldn't say necessarily within science itself, although some may disagree with that too. But it comes back to the question of how and where are ethical decisions made? Are they made by the scientists? And as sort of a self-regulating process with nobody else in the loop, in the problem-solving process? Or is it a larger decision process?
That's not the only place there's an issue. I wish I knew more physics and chemistry and stuff, but I do know social science. And I would say that social science imitated natural science. We got our worldview, a mechanistic worldview, out of social science, out of natural science. We applied it to social science, and we had kind of separated particles relating to each other, and they took it over in their social science. Some did, some didn't, but a great many did. And so we got a whole theory of how the world is and how we are. Now the science that I hear here and there has a quite different worldview with quantum physics, mm-hmm. quite different view of the world. Mm-hmm. So from my point of view, that mechanistic view taught us that we were kind of billiard balls externally related to each other. And so that's the way we treated each other. Now we got another theory, but we haven't caught up with the theory of the scientists now. We're still back in the billiard ball, and our social science is still back, for the most part, in the billiard ball theory of how life is. Now, I take my hat off. I mean, of course, it agrees with me, and that's why I take after this reason. Because, you know, I've been in that ball game ever since I studied Whitehead. It was a physicist and developed this sense of interconnectedness, which we now get out of science. So it's not simply the scientists being responsible. The very stuff of science, the very stuff of our educational system can be useful or hindrance, it seems to me, in looking at the issue of the environment. Because if we treat the environment simply as something out there, instrumental, only relationship is instrumental, like we treat each other for the most part, on the theory that we are not really connected to the earth. I mean, it's not a part of us. If you have that theory, then you act differently, I think. So I think you guys have got a, if you follow where science seems to be going, and I just, you know, get intimations of it, you've got something to say to most of us in the way we conceive of our being. I really think so. And I'm one who thinks that the way we look at being is the crucial issue in terms of what we do, how we treat each other, and what our whole society becomes.
Yeah.
One thing that we haven't mentioned here is money. And in this country, and in all countries, I guess, there's a certain pot, and in our country, we use more than what's in that pot. And the decisions are made about how to use that money. And I don't, and I think that everybody in this room, from what I've gathered and just meeting people during this last few days, agree that the way we're using money in this country is bad, it's very destructive, and it's very misplaced. I think we need to think about that, and I don't agree that necessarily money needs, that we would not want to see money decreased to science if science is developing Star Wars, for instance. I mean, most of us did not want them to go on with Star Wars, but it's a partly it has to do with the businesses that control a lot of what happens in Washington and that wanted to see this continue. I think part of it is that it's a lot of the things we do in science, from what I hear, are very intriguing. They're very exciting. But the kinds of things that Al is talking about maybe aren't that exciting, but they're a heck of a lot more important. And if I think we need to say, come on, that's enough. What we need to do is get going on this kind of dialogue from the time you're very small to develop responsible people who look at the world in a responsible way. And I don't think we can leave it to our politicians to designate people to do public policy, because they are not looking out for us. I don't know either. I don't know what they're looking out for. They don't pocket books or what it is, but
they're a motley crew. Just like us.
Okay, anybody else before? Yeah.
We've had a real interesting event in my community. The water supply is threatened. There's a big argument between the scientists of the area about whether or not it is caused by a variety of problems. But it's odd that there is a clear cut, and it's damming the river from which the water is taken. So then you get into an ethic and a public policy. The governor of our state, who is a Weyerhaeuser, sent a Weyerhaeuser plane to take the Forest Service man up to make the examination. Now, something's not right. So, you know, where does the ethics come in on this? And they're to decide how this is to be cleaned up.
Responses to that from the panel at all?
Scientists.
I don't know. Okay. I mean, the number of the questions that have come up, you know, it's easy to make quick cynical comments about government and the government process, but it seems that there is something about the structure of power that somehow, however the politicians are elected, and some way that it's structured, that it seems to, there's something that seems inherently wrong with it, that it tends to promote itself, its own interests, rather than that of the people. We had the Indian activist Gerald Clifford on our campus several years ago from South Dakota, and he began his speech saying that whenever our people get together to decide and make a decision that affects the future, we think how it's going to affect seven generations down. And my first kind of reaction was, oh, that's, you know, what a neat thing to say. But when I thought about that, I mean, I've never imagined my own grandchildren. I never think about that. And certainly our political system isn't geared so that our politicians are making decisions in the interest of our children seven generations. Not to say that they're all corrupt, but they're in part making their decisions to respond to election in 2 or 4 or 6 years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's have another comment here. Okay, please.
In listening to all this, I find this really kind of fascinating. And I've thought a lot about these things, and, you know, just going to sum up some of my thoughts of how I've kind of put things in my view. But I see one of the basic problems in this country is that our education system really stinks. It prepares us to do work, but it doesn't prepare us to be thinking about our work. And I'm not blaming science at all for the problems that are going on, because I don't see it as science's responsibility to decide what we're going to do next. They should continue growing, learning, searching, finding new things, but it's the general public's responsibility to make decisions. We want to live in a democracy, therefore it is our responsibility to make those decisions, but the problem is we're not prepared to make those decisions. Our education system doesn't prepare us to think about issues. We don't learn that at home, we don't learn that at school, and we don't learn it in the church, we don't learn it anywhere. So now we're at the mercy of everybody, hopefully doing what's right, and that doesn't happen. Everybody starts pursuing their own interests, and that usually means money, greed, power, and things like that. Another thing that I think about a lot too is the economic system of this country. It's based on short-term turnover profits. I worked for a company, and that's the big thing. Every 4 months, you must be profitable. And that doesn't lead to long-term thinking, because you're always interested in short-term turnover profits. That has nothing to do with the future, except hopefully investing your money in wise decisions and buying up other small companies. But that's all based on consumption. And consumption doesn't mean conserving what we have. And therefore, our whole economy is functioning in this eat it up sense. And we have to educate ourselves into this idea that it's not ours to waste. But if you're going to speak like that, then you're talking majorly changing our whole economic system into something that's not going to continue to waste and consume. We get blamed as consumers for the environmental problems because we buy this stuff. And I say, well, wait a minute, the company's making it, and they're advertising, and they're convincing us we need it. And it's an easier lifestyle, so sure, we buy it. But then whose problem is it? Is it the company's problem? Is it my problem?
It is your problem.
It's all of our problems, but yet it's so easy to blame the consumer's problem. The consumer, but we're not educated not to buy those things that are harmful. And the money is against you, actually, because it's in advertising to convince you you need it. So therefore, you're sitting behind the eight ball all the time, practically.
Okay, Mark, you want to respond?
Just a quick response. I just had an idea about your points about capitalism. I had a student do a paper on this last semester on the relationship between communist ideology and the environmental degradation in Eastern Europe, which is a lot worse than it is in the United States. And one of the things that she brought out in her paper was that the communists believe there are many problems by nature perfect, and it will be in perfect agreement with nature. And to say that there are environmental problems means to question the communist ideals. That's a simplified one. But in discussions that we had afterwards, we discussed also that capitalism makes similar kinds of statements, that as long as we've got the economic wheels greased and people are producing, we don't have to worry about these other problems. They're going to take care of themselves. There'll be supply and demand, all this kind of thing. And I think I think you're absolutely right, that one of the consequences of being more environmentally aware is that it's finding that communism doesn't work and capitalism.
It was called the green thumb, the invisible green thumb.
It's very interesting because they had the institutions to take care of long-term interests, but they didn't have the being to use them. Mm-hmm. We don't have the institutions to take care of long-term interests because we don't allow anybody except the interaction of self-initiations to make a decision, really. We don't want anybody to sit up there and think, what's that going to do to my grandchildren? Because our grandchildren aren't represented in this process of interaction that we have here. The future of the world is not, how can nature vote? How can the soil vote, you know, in an economic system, the way our system? You got to have people somehow who really, and Aristotle said a long time ago, the best government is a combination of aristocracy and democracy. Aristocracy is where you've got people who think about the common long-term good. That's what an aristocrat is. We have given up the notion of aristocracy.
Now, let's see. Andy, you've been wanting to get in for some time. Okay?
He's been in, of course.
I know.
Well, I can't help myself. That's about 40 years ago, in Dearborn, Michigan, as a member of the Education Committee of the American Society of Tool Manufacturing Engineers, we saw all of this that we've been talking about then. And we said, who's going to take our place? And we were looking forward, back at that time, to these fellows. They were just gleaming somebody's eyes in some cases, but we knew we were going to come to this. And we started what was referred to as a continuing education program, and which is going on till today. And what it amounted to was trying through the efforts of industry, which the society was representing, was trying to get industry and the educational institutions close enough together where at least they were talking the same language, advocating the same ethics and long-range thinking and education, or the continuing education that came in, to try to be in a position to answer these questions today. What this is making me wonder now is, were we successful with it or not? I thought we had done a pretty good job of it, because we did get chapters started at most of the technical type schools and institutions throughout the U.S. And it has been pretty successful, I thought. And now what I'm hearing is that maybe we're not successful with it. Maybe it is still isolated in the institution, and it's not out to the industry and people of the industry as it should be. I like these, what were youngsters when I was talking about
on the cusp
like
of the baby boom,
comment from them on what this, that, but I know they've heard of it, and what has this meant to you? Has it just not sunk in, what we were talking about, or what?
I can speak for Weber State, that where I come from in Utah, as one example, and it's still a very commonly practiced process in terms of continuing education. An ongoing educational resource at a lot of institutions around the country. Weber State happens to have a very active continuing education program. But something I've noticed in the 7 years I've been at Weber State now is a real difference in education as it applies to that program versus our usual students. The students that come through and expect to graduate in 4 years, actually these days across the country the average is shifting more to 5, 6, 7 years. But in any case, those students are coming in focused on a degree. They want to come in, they want to get out relatively quickly as possible. And we've got counselors in high schools that are telling some students, and I've had many students tell me this, that their counselors tell them, don't go into science, it's too hard. Do something else. And so those students do that. They come through, they take the science courses that they think are the easiest ones, which for me turns out to be a benefit because they take astronomy thinking they're taking astrology. And we end up with large classes and they're trapped. But those students go out trying to get away with the bare minimum to satisfy their science credits. Then we see them again in a few years when they realized what they had done and they come back through the continuing education programs. And so that has helped somewhat. But it's the early stages, the earlier stages of getting them in and focusing on what I would like to see, a more intense view of their science education as they're going through school to begin with. It would be a great benefit.
Upstairs.
Well, I think that's really intriguing because I'm really wondering where exactly and in what discipline, because we know schools are carved up into disciplines in most cases, although education is moving towards interdisciplinary work in a lot of cases. I'm really wondering where exactly that takes place, if in education, because there's a large population. And I think most of high school, since it still is a somewhat elite group that goes to college and university, where these questions can be asked. Because there's, you know, for example, religion can't be taught in high school because somehow values are involved. And we can't teach things that have values in them. Even as in public schools that, let me think, let me limit that then. In the public schools where I grew up, we did not have a single course from K through 12 that dealt with religion and different religions. And so what we found, what I found in the religion department at PLU, is everyone was equally uneducated in the area of religion, because they either had, as far as, not equally uneducated as far as the content of their own religion, but as far as the content of the variety that's out there and the range that you were talking about involved in science. And in the same, by the same token, the science that I learned was value-free. Was science is value-free. I took, you know, honors biology, honors chemistry, honors physics. And in all of those courses, there was very little ambiguity. And I just wonder, because every time you try and teach values in a school, you get, you know, some slack from people who say, well, there is only one answer, or we can't really decide that. So I wonder how we're going to, or where you would suggest that come in more practically.
Okay, panel responding to that? Okay.
Can I just a brief response? I think Al has okay. a chance to respond here because it, you know, what you said is that there's values all the time. You can't teach anything without context of value.
That's my theory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay,
you teach.
If you teach.
and you're going to teach value.
And what I'm suggesting is by teaching three science courses in high school and not allowing it, you don't need even a religion course, but an ethics course, you're teaching a certain value right there. Because, not in terms of what science could be.
Okay, one word from a sponsor. We're going to quit in about 2.5 minutes and 4 nanoseconds. That's what science is. So, you haven't talked yet, so go
I
ahead.
I have just one remark to make, closing statement. I'm getting my head chopped off, but that's okay. It's been chopped off before.
Goes back.
And this is no insult intended, but I've sat in forums of this type, maybe not as much, nearly as much as some of you have. But I've been in public education for 38 years, and I, not once was a value judgment contested by my superiors or anybody. Oh, there were some disputes, but I felt that right came out. But the key question is the individual. We've been talking about institutions. Institutions are reflections of society. It begins with the individual. Every one of us have the power to do things. When I came here, I thought, well, this is neat. But the things about recycling, that's not new to me. I've been recycling newspapers for 30 years, and I learned it from a lady who lived to be 86 or 96. And I'm not belittling the program. I think it's great. But you pick up things even as a little toddler, and all your way through, whether you're in an ethics course or a physics course or whatever, it doesn't have to be in a formal course. You learn a lot more in life than you do in the classroom. And just how well you tune yourself into what's around you is what makes the difference. And we've been talking about us or the United States of America, but you're forgetting the global projection too. Well, few references were made to it. But I think the key starts with the individual and your relationship with other people, your world around you. Let's start there. Let's not knock these institutions. You can't blame science for things or these social scientists. Sure, we all have a part in it, or the communists, or democracy, or our economic system. You have to look at yourself first. And I think if you can get more of these kinds of things going, what am I doing? Do I decide to walk to work a mile and a half, or do I drive my car? That's a decision I made 40 years ago. And there are things that I do, and they're normal, natural with me, and I don't think I've missed out on anything. I've never bought anything from a billboard or magazine ad or TV ad. Those are decisions that we have to start making right here, right now. And you cannot start saying, well, we'll change these institutions and that. It doesn't work. The communists try.
Okay, we'll have one more closing comment. And you are the lucky person.
Okay. I'm going to close on an optimistic note. It may not sound optimistic, but every one of us, not us, every one of the children that have been born since 1945 have grown up in an atmosphere of fear, distrust, and maybe even cynicism. I'm not putting any blame anywhere. It's, you know, these are just things that happened. In the Soviet, let me stick with us first. I think what we're going to have to do is look at the Indian perspective a little bit. And that is to look ahead. When our generation dies off, and since the Soviet Union has given up the ghost of trying to manipulate their own society and are calling for a genuine end to this Cold War hysteria, and we get rid of our own generation in the White House, in the Supreme Court, in the Congress, I think the younger generation is going to take hold, and I think we're going to see the kind of change that we are despairing. And that's all I want to say.
Thank you for coming, and